Well, hello, and welcome to another episode of Endeavors. On today's show, I speak with author, professor, and academic Alistair Bonnett on his book, Multi-Racism: Rethinking Racism in a Global Context. That's coming up on Endeavors. Well, hello. Welcome back. I know what I said, but it looks like I'll be just doing one show a week for right now. I wish I had the capacity, the resources to do two shows a week like I used to, and Marc Maron talks about it a lot in his thing about how they remain committed to doing it, twice a week. But things change, especially when you work, a job that is sometimes 12, 13, 14 hours a day, 5 days a week, and there just physically isn't the time. And I wish that I could do this full time. I wish that I could make this profitable in some way. And who knows? Maybe one day I can, maybe one day I will. And I mention that because this chat today represents, I think, what I want or what I'm hoping the future of this show, of this podcast, will be like. Maybe not every interview, but certainly I would like to do more of these types of chats, these types of talks. That's not to say I don't still enjoy interviewing artists, because I do. And as someone who grew up in the arts, that's always where I've been more comfortable, is in that environment, and you can get a lot of really good talks out of creative people. But as I come up on 12 years of doing the show in some form or another, from CJSF to CITR to both a podcast and a show, and now just a podcast, I don't know. I feel I'm a morphing, a changing. I feel like I need to reframe the show a little bit, and maybe my approach, maybe my topics are too broad. Maybe I need to narrow the focus more. Although I've always thought, in some way, even though it's always been an arts show, I've always thought that it's about the intersectionality of art and politics, or arts and culture, however you want to define that. And, maybe I need an even more narrow focus. You know, like Gilbert Gottfried, for example, who sort of does older, you know, old Hollywood, if you will, and almost old B-list Hollywood, for a way, you know. Or Jesse Brown, who's got, you know, media and political criticism. But at the same time, I've always just done interviews with people and about things that I find interesting. And, you know, maybe I have too much of a broad range. You know, I've always thought this to be a, you know, in a way to be an everyman type of show, which is kind of what makes this talk interesting. It's with Alistair Bonnett, who is a professor of social geography at Newcastle University in Newcastle, England. His previous books include Off the Map, Beyond the Map, New Views, The World Mapped Like Never Before, What is Geography, and The Age of Islands. His newest is Multi-Racism, Reexamining Racism in Global Contexts. And, you know, I have covered this sort of thing before. You know, I've talked with Slavoj Žižek about, you know, race and philosophy and politics. I've spoken with the city planner for education for the city of Helsinki. You know, a community organizer and bicycle activist in Copenhagen. But this felt different, I guess, because, you know, it's more of a long form interview, which is what I've been gravitating to lately and what I enjoy more than the short form 10-15 minute interviews. I just think they work better for my style, my sensibilities, and sort of, I think, what I want this show to morph into, if it will. I don't know. I don't really know what I'm saying by telling this story or expressing my thoughts. Not that I necessarily have a massive listenership, but I think things will just sort of change organically, as they do. I definitely want to put this post up on Patreon, Substack, maybe a few other sites, and maybe start and maybe use this as a way to push not a crowdfunding, you know, but maybe like a Patreon subscription or something like that. Anyway, I've rambled on far too long. This is my interview with Alistair Bonnett. So I'm here with Alistair Bonnett. Hello. Hi. You've written a new book or essay on multi-racism, you know, and I think in society we just hear the word racism used as sort of a be-all end-all, you know, catch-all. The idea of multi-racism as a concept, how do you explain what it is, and does it differ from your sort of traditional bread and butter racism?
Well, thanks, Dan. This book, Multi-Racism, Rethinking Racism in Global Context, that's the title, and it's a response to the way that racism is being called out across the world. It is being used as a term to explain people's oppression, whether it's in Syria or India or Indonesia, in North Africa, in Latin America, in a huge variety of places, in ways which is sometimes quite new. And what I'm interested in doing in multi-racism is listening to these new conversations, trying to understand them. I'm not so interested in trying to impose on any situation my definition of racism, because actually what people think of as racism varies enormously from one place to the next. The fact that people are talking about it in India, when to some outside observers, they might say, what are you talking about? This isn't racism. This is some difference in caste, for example, or some difference in religion between Muslims and Hindus. This isn't racism. Yeah, well, so I try not to do that. I try not to say, oh, no, you know, I know what it is. I try to listen, because people are putting this word to work and it is being used to explain their own experience to them. And basically, I'm calling for an internationalization of this conversation about racism, because ironically, it can be one of the most parochial forms of debate, in which nations get little regions get caught up in their own terminologies and conflicts, and don't realize there's a whole wide world, but also a changing world, where racism is increasingly being put to use, even where race isn't that apparent. It was a real journey, this book. I could have spent, you know, the rest of my life and many more lifetimes depicting the way racism is changing and evolving around the world, because it is happening in so many different ways, and so little of it is actually being reported back to us in anywhere. Actually just finding the sources could sometimes be a challenge. But as I say, people are increasingly being vocal, using this vocabulary, and so that helps.
You know, we're in an age of intersectionality. You know, you hear a lot about intersectional feminism and intersectional rights. Do you think that the conversation we're having about race and racism, and perhaps even the combating of it, can that be seen as intersectional?
Yeah, racism is nearly always an intersectional conversation. It's actually quite difficult to extricate forms of oppression and marginalization based on ethnicity and race from other forms. However, when you start looking at this internationally, you do have to start pluralizing this intersectional idea even further than it has gone. And so, coming back to India again, yeah, caste is a big part of people's reality, people's social reality in India. And you can't really talk about racism for people who are at the very bottom of the caste system, without talking about caste. And the reason I'm doing this is because so many people within that group, the Dalits or so-called untouchables, the 200 million plus people who are without caste, who are considered to be untouchable in India, many of the spokespeople of that movement are using this concept of racism to explain their social reality. So for them, intersectionality is about caste and about racism and about, other issues as well. So I just mentioned that it, because it shows us that as you take these ideas to different places, what the intersection is varies. So it isn't just a kind of like a kind of usual formula where we bring in gender or we bring in sexuality and we know what works in every single case. That isn't the reality. Different intersections work in different places.
You know, that you mentioned earlier about, different people of different cultures perhaps having different ideas of racism and what race means. And that brings us to Whoopi Goldberg. You know, she got in a bit of hot water a couple of weeks ago for saying, I think she said something like the Holocaust wasn't about race, which, you know, for a lot of Jewish people was patently offensive. And then she goes on to describe how as a Black person, you know, she sees race differently, even though she admitted what she said wasn't the right way to phrase it. And then she sort of said it was about both. What do you make of her initial statement and the conversation that came out of, as a result of that in terms of how we are even looking at race?
Yeah. Well, I'm not criticizing Whoopi Goldberg, but I am able to talk about the historical context of words such as race and racism. Racism only emerged as a term in the English language in the 1930s. And you can see this in the Oxford English Dictionary. It looks at the very first usages. Why did it emerge? It emerged in response to the biological racism of not just the Nazis, but the Nazis in particular, in Europe at that time, against the Jews and the Gypsies and the Slavs and a whole actually plethora of peoples. So racism as a concept actually emerged to challenge and to call out these forms of practice, which were against what we now regard as what you could call sort of white ethnic groups. So to pull the topic of the Holocaust out of the conversation and to suggest it's nothing to do with race or racism is very perverse. One of the things that the 20th century showed us was that racism can adapt and change. It's a flexible form. If we start imagining that there is one fixed form of racism, and we define it narrowly, yeah, we won't recognize it and acknowledge it in the past. And the effacement of racism in the Holocaust would be an example of that. But we won't recognize it in the future either, for when it's coming around the corner, because we've already seen in the years of the 21st century that we are still in an era of genocide. And actually, multi-racism, this book, does respond to that. It's striking and shocking to me that I am still teaching students about this topics of racism. And every year, there's a new ethnic genocide, a new form of mass racism, which we have to talk about. And often, these forms of persecution take people by surprise. It's like, oh my goodness, look what's happening in Myanmar to the Rohingya. Oh my goodness, look what's happening to the Uyghurs in China. And I could go on. The point is, this, oh my goodness, what a surprise, is because we have this rather fixed idea about what racism is. And if we are able to internationalize our concept, to realize that racism is not just, you know, one fixed form, but it should be called out wherever you find, inequality and discrimination based on racialized or ethnicized forms of power, wherever you see that, then we'll be in a much better place to deal with the racisms, and I'm afraid probably genocides that the rest of this century will show us.
That brings us to the idea that you talk about in the book, globalizing, or the globalization of whiteness. You know, I think which to some could sound, I think could be misinterpreted just because of how it's worded. What do you mean when you say, when you talk about the globalization of whiteness in a racial context?
Yeah, well, I mean, partly that term is a response to European peoples colonizing and dominating the rest of the planet and bringing their white supremacism with them. That actually, as a side effect, marginalized and displaced other ways of reading whiteness. In a previous book to this, which was about the history of whiteness, I looked at the way all sorts of people around the world used to call themselves white. It wasn't just the Europeans, but the Europeans, through the colonial moment and colonial racism, took hold of whiteness as their key symbol of superiority, and then ended up refusing to share it with anybody else. So it became only Europeans that were white. And that's the situation we're in, still in at the moment. Globalizing whiteness also reflects the spread of a neoliberal form of racialized capitalism, in which the ideal consumer is represented as this fun-loving white person. So often in advertising around the world, in Latin America or in East Asia or in India and so on and so forth, you'll find these sort of depictions of fair-skinned people having a lot of fun, smoking cigarettes, drinking whiskey, living in lovely apartments and so on. This sort of image of the ideal consumer has become wrapped up with images of whiteness. The white ideal, as it were, is globalizing in that way, although there is pushback. And over the past decade, really, people have been calling this out or resisting it and saying, we don't want to subscribe to a kind of white model. You find that in all the different places I mentioned. So again, it's about this fluid situation. It's not fixed. We can identify what's going on at the moment, but we've got to be open to the fact that the so-called white consumer ideal, you know, it may be fading. It may be something that doesn't last. Like a lot of consumer ideals, it's fast moving.
You know, just to touch on that, and this whole idea of anti-racism and whiteness, how conscious of the, you know, are you of the fact that here you are, you're writing this book about multi-racism and you know, the concept of racial identity, but you are also a white man.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I do talk about that in the book, and about my experiences growing up, first becoming conscious of racism. That is not a sort of like a set of experiences that gives me a sort of claim on knowing racism as an experience. And I don't think I've ever actually experienced racism. I still am in a position to be interested and engaged with the international conversations that are taking place about racism. It would seem to me irresponsible to walk away from those sorts of engagements, which is what they are, on the basis that I couldn't possibly understand, or it would be too difficult for me, or they are for somebody else. Very often, the situation in terms of who's white and who isn't is a little more complicated than some binaries suggest. There's quite a lot of, in the book about parts of the world, whether it's Russia, Turkey, actually also India, North Africa and China, where the situation of who's white and who isn't always very clear. People in North Africa will talk about themselves as white, and so will people in Turkey and the Arab world, and so on and so forth. I do try and complicate the story of whiteness along the way in multiracism, whilst not trying to sort of like make a claim on other people's experience or suffering.
Well, one of the things that you do, you have a whole section in the book called Whiteness in Japan, which is interesting because I think Japan specifically has often been singled out as having a very strong racial identity and almost homogeny in their country. And we're starting to see less of that now, but why did you find Japan specifically kind of an interesting case study when, you know, and especially looking at whiteness in sort of a non-predominantly white country?
Yeah. Well, one practical reason is there's an awful lot written about Japan, and this book, Multiracism, you know, I'm standing on the shoulders of others. So a lot of it is like reading material, secondary sources, trying to get what I can. And there's a very kind of lively, you know, academic community in Japan, and in many parts of the world, that is not the case. And it's really difficult to, for example, I have a whole section about Eritrea. It's actually really difficult to find out about the ethnic discrimination in Eritrea, even though it is clear it's going on and it's often very violent, but it's not written about. And in fact, the scholars there aren't many of them in Western universities. So that's one very practical reason. But it also points to the fact that one of the essays that inspired me to think about racism around the world was by a Japanese sociologist called Hiroshi Wagatsuma. And he, in 1967, did this survey of Japanese racial attitudes. And he really identified how strongly Japanese people identify with themselves as a race and having certain racial biases, such as towards paler skin. For Wagatsuma, actually, he said this wasn't about westernization. What was going on was there is additional traditional Japanese aesthetic traditions, and that Japan has its own, as it were, racial discourse, its own racial heritage and traditions. And it isn't just a question of like Japan or the Japanese absorbing Western prejudices. So I thought that was really fascinating and a kind of incisive, critical essay. And since then, other Japanese scholars have been writing about this, and because Japan is a, you know, quite an increasingly culturally confident country, a lot of what the more recent scholarship has been suggesting is that there is a kind of distancing from kind of white Western models, and using advertising again as an example, where white people are often displayed in Japanese advertising on the television and on posters. Often doing sort of transgressive things, not wearing many clothes, drinking whiskey, you know, this kind of like fun lifestyle, consumerist type of stuff where white people are often used in advertising around the world. But also recent scholarship is suggesting that the white Western people are often represented as quite clownish, as buffoonish, as a bit stupid, perhaps. And there's a lot of, you know, dynamism and movement. And there's also a new fashion in Japan and Japanese advertising for using black people and black bodies to sell things, and a kind of consumerization of blackness. So this kind of like dynamic but quite distinct national scene all suggested to me that Japan would be a good place to look.
You know, and sort of the flip side of that is you have somebody like Naomi Osaka, you know, who you know, had a Japanese, has a Japanese mother, has a, you know, Haitian, I think it's her father's Haitian American. When she won the U.S. Open, she was, you know, they were saying, oh, she was the first, first Asian person to win. And they sort of, half the articles erased her Japanese-ness, you know, her Japanese identity, the other half of the articles erased her sort of African-American and Haitian identity. And they tended to focus on one identity without talking about the other. Why is that a phenomenon, and how do we get past that?
Yes, it's a good question. Racial and ethnic language tends to lead people towards essentialism. In other words, thinking there's only kind of one particular essence that a person has. And the more complicated realities of so many people's lives are actually quite difficult to absorb. And there isn't really partly it's a vocabulary issue. People know what a Japanese person is or a Haitian person. But when they start hyphenating and putting diverse identities, it almost becomes like a red herring or a distraction in the kind of media consciousness. Because again, the way the media wants to approach things is in quite simple, straightforward, immediately understandable categories. And more hyphenated identities tend to require explanation. And therefore, there is almost an inherent sort of a media bias against them. Not sure this is a very good explanation of why we find it difficult, but I think the increasing prevalence of diverse individual identities is going to have to require a new kind of media sensitivity and maybe a new language around race and ethnicity. It may be what we have to do is just stop trying to immediately classify people as soon as we encounter them, that it becomes a kind of like secondary order characteristic of the person rather than the first thing that, you know, the Japanese tennis player, you see, it's the first thing right. That people will try. And you know, so if you do that, then it suggests that this is always going to be a stumbling block. I don't know. It's a tough one.
Much like gender in a way, you know, like people are saying, you know, someone about to ask Stephen Murray about, you know, Serena Williams, and they always say, oh, she is the best female tennis player. And he's like, well, she's actually won more majors than anybody, so she's just the best tennis player, you know, get rid of the honorific. But, you know, in terms of, I guess, sort of new ideas and new ways to talk about things, one conversation that's coming up a lot in the States, at least, is critical race theory. And you have a certain segment of that are very, you know, for and saying we should teach it. And then you have a lot of maybe the more older conservative right wing saying we don't need to do it. I don't understand it. Where are you on the idea of race as a critical sort of academic theory?
Yeah, well, this book, in a way, is critical race theory, but I think it's very clear that it is scholarship, that students and readers are going to learn a lot from it. They will know an awful lot more about the world by the end of it than they started with. I think some of the fears that surround critical race theory from people who don't like it is that it is a set of mantras or it's a polemic, that it's intellectually empty, those sorts of concerns. And I certainly don't, that certainly isn't necessary. However, I also try and show that ethnicity is just as important as race. There is this sort of hang up about race. If you look at national censuses, the number of countries that demarcate their populations by race is tiny. I mean, the United States does it, but, you know, nearly the whole world does not demarcate or classify its populations by race. And most of the world does not talk about race. They talk about ethnicity. Does that mean that racism doesn't exist in most of the world? Not at all. It means that there are different vocabularies. So I would try and have critical ethnic theory rather than just critical race theory, because I'm concerned that if you always stick with race, then you are always going to have a rather parochial conversation. You're always going to not be including most of the world, the 96% of the people on the planet who are not Americans. And I don't think that's a satisfactory situation if we're trying to have an anti-racist future.
You sort of mentioned Japan about their identity as it relates to sort of Western culture. And you see it a lot in third world countries and a lot of countries in Africa and in South America, these sort of a lot of heavily Western influences, you know, and like the early colonizers, the evangelical church would come over, set up camp in Africa, and then would sort of run the country. How much has the West influenced our current state of racism or current ideas that we have about racism?
Yeah, a lot, an awful lot. But it's not the only story. So traditionally in ethnic and racial studies, it was assumed that this Western colonial racism was not just a key story, but the only story. And what I try and do in multiracism is show and register the importance of that story whilst acknowledging distinct roots and traditions. And like I've indicated, I've been helped because there are new voices out there and new scholarship. Actually, talking of China, one of the key influences on me is a guy at the University of Hong Kong called Frank de Kerter. And his book on race in modern China is a brilliant exposition of the way racist ideas came in from the West and translated social Darwinian ideas in the late 19th century, were translated into Chinese, had a big influence, but they were adopted and adapted within an existing set of Chinese traditions that also had hierarchies of the world's peoples, but also had a sense of the center of the world and the margins of the world. They also had a clear sense of who was civilized and who was from the past. So Frank de Kerter in their book shows this kind of what he calls intercultural moment of exchange between racisms. And that was a real moment, revelation for me when I first got hold of Frank's book. And it's just an example of the kind of work out there, which is showing us new routes, new ways that we can think about these processes.
You know, given that the racism as a term didn't emerge until the 1930s, it's very modern. You know, I think you say racism is modern and modernity is racism. As we become a more modern society, whether it's through tech or through more openness and tolerance, will that actually increase racism?
Not necessarily. Yeah, I do connect modernity with racism because modernity has this set of intellectual techniques, for example, about designating people from the past, about saying they are primitive, and then designating people who are of the future or of the moment. And that sort of like temporal sense of looking at humanity is something intrinsic to modern civilizations, and also a sense of classification and mass society of industrial processes. You can't imagine, you know, the Holocaust in a pre-modern realm, because it was an industrial, rational, classificatory death machine. So modernity has this capacity for racism, but it isn't the only thing that modernity does. Another thing that modernity does is produce critical intellectuals and societies which want to inspect themselves and aren't content with the status quo. In other words, modernity produces racism, but it also produces anti-racism. And societies, as they become more modern, and often they're doing it in their own terms, I'm very keen to explain in the book that modernity is not just something that comes from the West, that there are different origins of modernity. And we're hearing this a lot now, and we will hear it a lot in the 21st century, you know, from different countries around the world, like in India and China, people explaining that they're not just copying the West, this is their modernity. So what will be happening there is the possibility of racism. But it's not inevitable. Modernity is what we are. We can't escape it. We're not stepping outside it. There isn't any other game. We are modern people, and we just have to try and navigate and negotiate the best form of modernity that we can.
There are many countries that, you know, pride themselves on that modernity and in that tolerance. For example, like you look at places like Scandinavia. I remember reading this about Sweden, but one of the criticisms that was said about that is that a society like that becomes so tolerant that they become tolerant of intolerance. Is there a line that has to be drawn there somewhere? And how do we go about finding that line?
That's a tricky one, isn't it? You've got to tolerate everything except intolerance, is the famous quote. I think there are different ways of looking at this. I mean, xenophobia, or people fearing foreigners, isn't going away and probably be here, you know, until the earth burns up in a fiery crisp. But racism, actual discrimination and the creation and maintenance of inequality between groups is something that we shouldn't be tolerating. And where that is making a difference in people's lives, we know we can do stuff about it and change it. And it isn't the case that once we've got racism, we're kind of stuck with it. One of the good things about a society is where this is a lively, sometimes quite conflictual debate, is that they are, in their own kind of like a knockabout way, trying to get to grips with this complicated topic and find a way through it. It tends to be countries, and obviously I've looked at a lot in this book, Multiracism, it tends to be countries where no one's talking about racism, where no one's talking about ethnic discrimination. Why not? Well, because if you do, you will quite likely get locked up or disappeared or have a bullet in the back of your head. And the book is actually dedicated to the Scholars at Risk charity, because the Scholars at Risk are monitoring, you know, plenty of people have tried to write about racism and discrimination in countries and have just been disappeared. There's a whole bunch of several scholars are trying to write about the situation of the Uyghurs in China who have been disappeared and no one has heard from them. Not to be complacent about countries where there is a lively, disputous debate about this, but that's much preferable to places where you can't talk about it.
Well, just touching on that briefly, you know, that brings us up to the Olympics, which are happening right now. And, you know, now and even in Beijing in 2008, people were talking about the human rights record of China. You know, we got the whole thing with Russia happening. When there's a big international event like this, you know, that is where all countries come together or multiple countries come together, as much as people don't want to, politics will play a factor in some way. How do we use an event like the Olympics or the World Cup, for example, which is coming up in Qatar this year? How can we use that, an event like that, to talk about and try to heal racial divide?
Yeah, well, sometimes countries that hold these events do try and clean up their act, and Qatar has tried to do this with its treatment of migrant workers. Although people are suspicious that this is a kind of a facade, no country likes to have bad press. And it will go to quite extreme lengths, as in China, to stop people reporting on ethnic discrimination or development of a mass internment system, as we see in northwest China. So these events can intrinsically shine a light and enforce countries to respond to these sorts of questions. But it's interesting that some countries are just to have more power than others. Qatar is a tiny, tiny place. It needs to look good. China at the moment is quite a bullish country, and it isn't that worried what the West thinks about it. This is the nature of the 21st century. We're seeing a multipolar world emerge in which particularly China, but also perhaps India, are becoming unafraid, kind of uninterested in what Western critics might say about them. It's really, you have to look within China to find movement and hope there. And there's certainly There is plenty of that. There's plenty of Chinese scholars who have tried and have talked about these issues. So it's not a completely silent topic in China. China's a confident place. That's what I'm saying, and it feels that it can do what it wants.
Speaking of China, it's interesting because I think with COVID, we're seeing racial issues in largely new ways. When the pandemic started, there was a lot of xenophobia. There still is. I mean, that in itself is nothing new. But, I saw something on the ACLU yesterday where it said for every one vaccine that's sort of done in a third world country or developing country, 117 are administered in the West. That's a massive disparity. So this idea of not scientific racism, but how do you see that accessibility has become intertwined with racism, and how do we maybe go about lessening that gap?
Yeah, I think it's really doable. I mean, there's a big chunk of Africa and then Yemen, Afghanistan, who have been left out. And that isn't the majority of the world. It's, particular big chunk of it. It wouldn't be a huge push. It wouldn't be undoable, I'm saying, to provide enough vaccines for those parts of the world. And that obviously is in the interests of everybody. The thing is about the vaccine technology, it also is pointing towards this multipolar world of ours, because obviously China has a variety of vaccines, so does Russia, but so has Iran, has developed a vaccine, Turkey, I think Cuba have developed a vaccine. There's a whole panoply, a whole medicine shelf of different vaccines out there, because the research and development capacity is no longer just concentrated in some labs in the United States and Germany. And we are seeing the capacity to deal with the pandemic emerge in the so-called third world. I don't know if the third world is even a useful category anymore when we have so much change going on. And indeed, the majority of the world's citizens now live in upper or middle income countries. This is, you know, quite a recent transition, and we're still kind of catching up with it. But the pandemic, for me, yes, it shows that, you know, there's whole groups of places, countries that have been left behind. What a danger that is, but also that there are new places of research and power, because a lot of the, you know, for example, China's used its vaccine as a form of soft power, distributed it around the world, you know, and so is India, so is Turkey, and so on and so forth.
I think another form of racism that is being talked about a lot these days is environmental racism. There was a documentary about, I think it was the president or prime minister of Maldives about 10 years ago, and they talked about how those islanders are going to become the first environmental refugees. How much is climate change playing a part in racism and racial identity and race theory?
Yeah, I think... it is, and indeed, environmental racism is becoming, you know, one of the key areas of discussion and research in ethnic and racial studies. And climate change is having its earliest and most adverse impacts in some of the poorest places in the world, whether they're small islands or whether they're in parts of Africa which are experiencing much higher temperatures. And of course, people are being pushed out of those places and they're having to seek new lives, very often in places which are not welcoming them. So that sense of climate change producing, you know, new conflicts, new fronts, new flows of migration. Yeah, this is something that we're going to see more of in the 21st century. It's not entirely predictable kind of which direction it's going to go on. But one of the other things I do is write travel books, and written a recent travel book called The Age of Islands, which took me to islands around the world and some Pacific islands. Why I am saying this is that it is amazing how resilient people are on those islands. The rest of the world may be saying, you know, you can't stay here. The seas are rising. It's too stormy and so on and so forth. But islanders really often don't see a plan B. They're just hanging on. I do remember conversations I had in Tonga where I did field work for the book. And Tonga is really battered. When I was there, it was like almost underwater, not literally, but, you know, there were huge pools of water absolutely everywhere. But the idea that people were going to leave somewhere they'd lived for 3,000 years, which has a, you know, history going back millennium, that wasn't an option. It was like, no, this is where we are. This is where we're staying.
You know, we were talking about China, which, you know, and Russia, which are both, you know, sort of communist states. There's, you know, they're also heavily capitalist. And you talk about this in your book, you know, capitalism, socialism, nationalism. How does any ism, if you will, affect our discussions about racism? And do you see racism differently in, you know, a capitalist society versus a socialist society? Yeah. versus a communist society?
Well, I think these are good questions, and it has been assumed in the West for many a year that communist societies did not have a problem, and they certainly projected that discussion of race and racism was effectively banned in China when the Communist Party took over. And that's the same as happened in the Soviet Union. Why? Because the ideology was that racism could only exist in capitalism. And therefore, if you have a communist society, there cannot be any racism. It follows that you can't even talk about it. So what effectively happened was that racist government policies and racism generally was just pushed under the carpet. And for example, in the USSR, obviously you saw some of the largest deportations and movements of whole ethnic communities in world history, whole groups of people, whether the Chechens or English or whole alphabet of different ethnic communities in the Soviet Union were deported en masse. They were seen as guilty of having a political suspect character, of being unreliable, not just one or two or individuals, but everybody, women, children, everybody. And that actually explains a lot of the resentment, for example, in Chechnya against the Russians, because that whole community was deported and then they had to kind of like find their way back. So you get this process in communist regimes of a collective punishment. And actually, you want to find one of the most racist periods in the 1970s, you could go to Cambodia, and Cambodia under the Khmer Rouge, Khmer being the majority ethnic group in Cambodia. And their whole policy was about purifying the country of Vietnamese and then purifying the Khmer people of anything that was non-Khmer. A real explicit racial ideology that tied communism to racial purity. So communism, like capitalism, have these potential exclusionary racist dynamics. We have to be watchful for that rather than just assume that, when the glorious revolution comes, everything will be okay, because the 20th century has shown us that didn't happen.
Speaking of the glorious revolution and this idea of, you know, racism ingrained in the state, I don't know if you've been following kind of what's been happening here in Canada the last month with the convoy, as people are calling it, you know, in the capital, Ottawa. They've cleared the Ambassador Bridge, but it's kind of scattered throughout the country. And in Ottawa specifically, there was a lot of criticism that the police didn't act, and that if the makeup of the convoy was, you know, BIPOC, and that if it was a BLM protest or an Indigenous rights protest, it would have ended before it started, and perhaps quite aggressively. But because the protesters are largely Caucasian, that didn't happen. Do you agree with that? And how does that show just how systemic these issues are?
Yeah, well, it's a little tricky for me to judge from this distance, but that whole process in which the Republican Party in the United States has got taken over by a Trumpist ideology, which seems to embolden a certain white identity politics, and then played out in the storming of the Capitol, where again, a whole extraordinary confrontational situation happened that made spectators think, well, if they were black, you know, they wouldn't have been let anywhere near, the Capitol building. So, it sounds like something similar could be playing out in the Canadian thing with this convoy. And it's amazing how these expressive, you know, spectacular events seem to sort of claim an identity. Well, in fact, as I understand it, most truck drivers are quite happy with the vaccine policy. This is a minority who have been able to sort of seize the headlines and kind of distort the nature of the wider opinion of the community they claim to represent.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, like a lot of the people there aren't vaccinated. You know, earlier on there was even support from the vaccinated community just against the mandates, but you know, a lot of the laws that they're protesting are actually provincial, not federal, right? Which would, it's, I guess, sort of in England would be the equivalent of like a county law, or, you know, I know England doesn't have, the division of parliament, government isn't the
it's
same.
It's interesting what you say, when you use the word the vaccinated community, because one of the things I look at in the book is how identities and ethnicities sort of come about, and they can often come about in quite sort of unusual, unexpected ways. And what's happening with the COVID thing, where we actually, because I've talked to a bunch of people, I've got friends who are not just unvaccinated, it's become key to their identity. It's what Absolutely. They are. They hang out with other people who are unvaccinated. They talk to them on the internet. And it's almost like it's the elephant in the room when you're anywhere near them. And so there's this sort of new social division and a kind of collectivity arising, not so much amongst the vaccinated, because, you know, we are the great majority, but amongst the unvaxxed, we're seeing them somehow coalesce into a group, an identifiable group.
Do you think that's going to further divide society at all, especially with the fact that we're seeing this huge rise in extremism, in often which has a racial output, and that, you know, whether you're unvaccinated or, you know, you're a white nationalist, you don't even want to have a conversation. You know, I like, and it's not just them. The other side doesn't want to have a conversation too, because they don't know how to approach, and they think it won't be successful. And so what do we do when we can't even talk to one another?
Yeah, it's really hard. I mean, it's not as if I have any sort of magic wand. All I've got is, you know, a scholarship and knowledge. But I, you know, what I do see is how things go very badly, very quickly. And often people are very complacent about these types of scenarios in which they say, oh, it'll just die out. You know, people get over it. Time will heal the wounds. And that does happen. And one hopes it would happen. But also you can get situations, and I've seen this so many times, and the different examples I use, where there's a bit of, you know, tension, there is signs of something. It doesn't look like it would lead to internment camps or genocide, but it does. And things run away. The situation gets out of control, and people feel free to use violence, whether they're agents of the state or whether they think they're acting against the state. In terms of racism, you know, we do actually have incredible laws at a national, you know, provincial, and international level against racism. You know, every country in the world, if you look at the laws there, you would think, well, what's the problem? There isn't going to be any issue with discrimination if I kind of look at the laws of North Korea, but the reality of it is that those laws don't happen. The reality is that the United Nations, which has all these incredible treaties and principles about racism, does not implement those treaties. It doesn't have the power to do it. And so countries can just appear in front of the, you know, International Committee on the Elimination of Discrimination and say, no, we've got no problem. Like, you know, reports I've been reading from Pakistan, who go before that committee, people are talking about discrimination in that country, and they just say, no, it doesn't happen. And in fact, the Pakistani government says there are literally no ethnic groups in that country. End of story. So the UN's response is, oh dear, we're not quite sure about that, but it has no teeth. And what I'm getting at here is that one of the ways that we can respond and heal to these situations should be through legal measures, of which there are so many, but they are not being followed, not being implemented, or the organizations that have them don't have any, you know, teeth, as in the case of the UN.
I think, you know, one of the concepts that people, who are on more the extreme side of things tend to say is, oh, reverse racism, you know, indigenous communities or BIPOC communities, you know, calling out white people or discriminating against white people. Is reverse racism a concept, or is it just racism against white people coming from another community, or is it nothing at all?
Well, yeah, my approach in this book is just to listen to what people are saying about racism and try not to say they're wrong. If people are saying they're experiencing racism, I don't sort of like rush in and say, oh, no, that isn't right, according to my definition. So the whole point of my work is to show the plurality of this debate. And it's, so I admit to the possibility of white people experiencing racism, but they would need to show the kind of evidence that I hear from all the other kind of parts, the people I've engaged with in this book, whether Papuans in Indonesia or Uyghurs in China, who are able to show inequality, discrimination on a daily and systematic basis. I've never actually seen that in the UK, for example, where a lot of people complain about racism against whites. But if you look at what they're talking about, what the evidence is, it seems to be a set of intuitions or feelings and nothing concrete. So I don't want to be dismissive about that. It's a possibility. But at the same time, it doesn't seem a very strong argument.
You know, and then the other side of that, and I are people who say, oh, I don't see race. You know, Bill Nye actually said a few years ago, there is no such thing as race. Can that be equally as problematic because it actually erases people's racial identity, which they actually really want and need?
Yeah, it's certainly problematic in countries where race identity is to the fore and where it's important in the way people see themselves and where they have kind of like agency in the world. You know, if you deny people's race, then that means that they can't have any collectivity. They can't do anything in terms of challenging and changing the world. However, as I indicated earlier, a lot of countries in the world, people don't talk about race, and we don't want to start imposing that vocabulary on them. A lot of people talk about their identity in different ways, often in terms of ethnicity, but also in terms of religion and caste and so on. So I do try in the book Multiracism to admit to that diversity, and to hear people and the way they talk about their identity and the way they connect that to racism.
One of the concepts we hear is this idea of a post-racial society. Do you think we can ever get there? And what does that look like?
Yeah, I think in a way we are already, because the concept of race, even though people hang on to it in various ways, is being eroded. The ideas of ethnicity are still going to be there because so many people want to express their cultural affiliations and national and regional and so on. So ethnicity isn't going anywhere, but I can imagine notions of race, which are often rooted in sort of biological determinism and really unscientific notions of human difference, will be put aside. And in many places they have, you know, speaking from England, there used to be a whole thing about the races of Britain. And the Irish, for example, were seen as a separate race, and they weren't seen as just separate. They were seen as inferior, hence the policies of the Victorians to Ireland, virtually sort of driving Irish, Catholic Irish out of Ireland. Same thing actually happened with the Scots. They were seen as different races, literally. And today that all seems very bizarre. There are still, hangovers from that. When I was at school, there was a lot of anti-Irish racism and a lot of anti-Irish jokes. But that was some time ago. And why I'm telling you this story is that effectively the British Isles, even though it's, you know, screwed up in all sorts of ways, has moved to a kind of like post-racial situation where people where if you start using anti-Irish racism, you'd be like, what are you talking about? People just would be bewildered,
right?
You know, they wouldn't understand it. Yeah, so that shows a point of progression as compared to what we had in the past.
You know, just I wanted to bring this up because it just happened a couple of days ago and it affects Britain. The first Chagos Islanders returned home, like I think 3 or 4 days ago, and That's been a quite a long running issue for the last, I think, 30, 40 years between the UK and Mauritius. What do you make of the fact that the tribunal basically ruled that the Chagos Island, you know, belong to Mauritius, are their own people, and that Britain just needs to cut their losses and get out of there?
It's extraordinary, Saka. I really can't understand how Britain had the right to get all the Chagos Islanders to leave. I mean, it wasn't even that long ago. They did it because apparently the Americans wanted them to do it. And that tends to be the nature of British foreign policy. Just do what you're told by the Americans. But, was it the 1980s or something?
It's like 81, I think, something like that.
Incredible. Incredible. I mean, this comes back to what I was talking about in terms of international law. What is international law for? It is not to say, no, you can't actually evict a whole population from a place which is their home. So, it seems an extraordinary and shameful act. And it doesn't get much publicity in Britain at all, because the Chagos Islanders, there's not many of them. It's almost by, you know, demographic impact, because it's such a small population. But in terms of, you know, legal principle and moral principle, it's a really indicative and a shameful episode.
You know, I think two other islands that continually come up in discussion are Gibraltar and the Falklands, which I think is a little bit different just because of the racial makeup of those two islands. But do you think this saga with the Chagos, although it's not the same, and what happened with Brexit, will that reignite the conversation about those two dependencies?
It may do for Gibraltar, because Brexit is a bit of a nightmare for Gibraltar, being stuck onto Spain. Brexit is a bit of a nightmare, full stop. The Falkland thing is just they're not really so impacted by the Brexit debacle, but the Brexit thing is going to start causing new types of ethnic division, much more significant. Living here in Newcastle, I'm only like 30 miles or so from the Scottish border, and obviously Scotland and the Scots are not wanting Brexit. What Brexit is the English exit, so this increased severance, which has real ethnic resonance between the Scots and the English, is coming to the fore. And I'm pretty sure that Scotland will not just seek but get independence in the next few decades. And then I'm going to have an international border on my doorstep, all sorts of issues. Again, it's coming back to the idea that what looks like it's, you know, not such a problem, maybe all right, yeah, just wait and see, actually quickly it can get worse and worse, yeah, and worse if you're not careful.
Well, what's interesting, I noticed when I was in Scotland, about it strikes me that in a lot of ways it's a lot more racially tolerant. Like it's rapidly becoming more modern in its policies. And, you know, I agree with you. I think Scotland's going to have another referendum and they're going to vote for independence. And then I think they're going to, once they're independent, they're going to rejoin the EU. Is this going to lead to the breakup of the UK? You know, I think Wales voted for Brexit just barely, but Northern Ireland, I think, voted to remain. How is this going to affect the future of the UK?
Yeah, you're right in your descriptions there. That's the irony of the British exit. It is actually going to cause the disintegration of Britain. So much for its patriotic flag waving of Britain when it's destroying the very thing that it claims to support, because it can't admit its kind of, in a way, ethnic content, which is English nationalism. It's all about this English identity, which does not, which is a very kind of unexpressible and subterranean form, because there is no English nation, there is no English parliament, and so on and so forth. But there has evolved a huge English sense of resentment. It's a bit like your Trump supporters, a huge sense of feeling that we are victims, that we are being taken advantage of, no one understands us. And at the same time, I don't think it really quite recognises itself or knows what it wants, because what's the symbol of Brexit? It's the Union Jack. It's not the flag of St. George, which is actually often seen as a quite racist symbol. If you see it flapping from someone's house, you can bet that they're not a particularly tolerant or friendly environment for people. So, yeah, it is causing the end of the UK, and that is not something I want. I want a federation of nations, and for me personally, being so close to the border, it's going to be, and like my partner, she's from a town which is like bisected by the border, Berwick-upon-Tweed, and for them, a lot of people in that area, they see themselves as British. They don't see themselves as Scottish or English. You know, actually British means a lot, and it's meant a lot for a lot of people in Canada actually, and around the world, for many hundreds of years. And this sort of British identity is being sort of tossed away rather casually, because without it, I'm not sure. Like, for a lot of minorities in England, they see themselves as British, Black British, Asian British. They do not regard themselves as English. English is an ethnic category, often just applied to white people, white English. So, you know, it's going to create these problems, I can't see a way out. I want to rejoin the EU. I think I might be the only person in England who wants that, but never mind.
Well, you know, one very strong part of not only English identity, but British identity is what football team you support, you know. And as a Canadian who just got his dual citizenship and might relocate to the Isles in the near future, what football team should I root for, and what kind of tea should I drink?
Well, you're really asking the probably final questions now, aren't you? you're moving into the more casual area. Well, it depends where you're thinking of going. I wouldn't plump for any of them yet. The Newcastle football culture is absolutely fanatic. And very kind of like tightly geographically framed. I mean, their big enemies are, you know, 10 miles down the road. And so you just have to wait and then plump for what hopefully is successful team. I was coming on to your second question about tea drinking. You know, tea is really expanded. You know, there's a new tea house opened up on the university campus where I teach. The whole idea of there being tea houses, the whole sort of like plethora of teas, is great. You know, tea is the new coffee. And it does open up the fact that tea, it used to be just this sort of brown rubbish. It's become a bit of an area for connoisseurs. So, I think, you know, I imagine there's some nice tea houses in Canada, in Vancouver or Victoria, rather.
Yeah.
Where you can train your palate.
Yeah, well, one phenomenon here is bubble tea, you know, because Vancouver has a very large Asian community, Vietnamese, Korean and Chinese. So there's a lot of bubble tea. But yeah, we've got great little kind of like, you know, we don't have so many tea shops. We have a lot, you know, nice little like kind of upscale cafes that have, you know, like tea or your tea lattes, or, you know, and you can get like pastries and with them and stuff. So, you know, and it's the city that I live in specifically is very British. I mean, it's called Victoria. And my neighborhood, we say that it's behind the Tweed Curtain. So yeah, we definitely have a lot of British influences.
I went to Victoria. I was amazed. I thought, oh my goodness, this seems to be a place where old British people go to die. It's extraordinary.
You're not wrong. When I was in high school, the joke about Oak Bay was its demographics was newlyweds or nearly deads. The average age in Oak Bay is deceased. So yeah, but yeah, very, very British. Australians too, but largely British. So yeah, no, it's a very yeah, but it's a very beautiful
I know it's beautiful.
city as
Absolutely.
well.
Yeah, I loved it. I loved it there. We seem to be breaking up a bit, Dan, every now and then, so maybe we
Yes.
should wrap it
Yeah,
up.
well, I think maybe Zoom, I think maybe the Zoom gremlins are giving us a sign that this interview is at its end. But Alistair Bonnett, thank you so much for your time today. I know we kind of zigged and zagged a little bit, but this was great.
Yeah, no, that was fun. Good talking to you, Dan, about an important topic.
Good talking to you as well. Thank you so much.
Okay, cheers.
Well, that about does it for me today. Please be sure to check out Alistair Bonnett's book, Multi-Racism: Rethinking Racism in Global Context. It's available from Polity Books. You can visit politybooks.com, Polity books.com. Thanks for tuning in. I'll see you next time. Bye for now.